Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Very well, Tom. Nice to be here on episode 99 or 100 or whatever it is.
Yeah, we haven't quite decided which one, but it's all of them are special to me.
This is particularly special, though. And we've got a particularly special guest, haven't we, Tom?
We do have a particularly special guest. We have Paul Staines with us. Paul is the founder and the outgoing editor of Guido Fawkes, the legendary political and gossip blog in Westminster. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing a few of these. It sounds like I'm hearing my own obituary every time I do one of these. Can we be a bit more positive? I haven't died.
No, exactly. You are very much alive. I would like to confirm that. But you are stepping down, Paul, as the editor of Guido Fawkes after 20 years.
I'm off the news treadmill.
And it's been a hell of a run. But also, I think it's one thing we want to talk to you about today was a bit about Guido and your tenure there, but also about how the media's changed in that time. But Guido was set up in, 2004? Can you give us a sense of what the landscape was like at that point and why you wanted to jump into it?
Well, it was the political landscape was we were coming to, well, I thought we were coming to the end of a shabby Labour government. I didn't think the opposition, the Conservatives, were much better. And I'd been introduced to this blogging software by Perry de Haviland at Samizdat, which is still going, by the way. And I was mixing libertarian circles. He was a sort of libertarian party animal, and he had this blog, which was a very new thing. You know, you could just write something and it appear on the internet, the World Wide Web, everyone could see it. And I wrote a few things for him, and I was a bit more gossipy and acerbic and more like a diary column. And he was quite a broadsheet output. I mean, it had a sense of humour, but they would write 3,000-word essays about someone else's 3,000-word essay and why it was wrong. And I'm sending in these short things. And he would tell me that, oh, I must have got lost in my spam filter, junk email or something like that. And eventually said, look, why don't you do your own? And I went, well, how do I do that? And he said, oh, you can just go and there's a free version called Blogspot. And Google do it, and you can just do it yourself. So I did, and I did everything wrong. And I had like 60 readers a day for about 2 months, 3 months. And, you know, eventually you got some scoops and some things that follow up. And it broke out of just being read by a few people in the know and people who knew me, because it would be on the paper, it'd be on the front page of a newspaper, and it would either be called Internet Sources or, heaven forbid, they might even mention the name of the publication. And that's how it grew in scale. But at the time, I think Paul Waugh was at the Evening Standard and he had started messing around with online stuff. And Ben Brogan at the Telegraph was doing it. And he had a young fellow called Stephen Bush working for him, I think. Whatever happened to him. And they were the only competition. And I, at the time, used to think I was just brilliant at getting news out. But really, it was because we didn't have a deadline. You know, newspapers were still stuck in that. We might break it at 6 p.m. on the internet if we can't hold, but we're going to keep it till 10 p.m. when we print the newspaper. And of course, I'd hear about it at whatever time and print it instantly, go to Pixel straight away. So my deadline was as fast as I could get it out. And that's the main change, I think, in the internet. I mean, to some extent, I think the 24-hour news channels obviously had a one-hour cycle. And then people like me made it as soon as we could get it out. And then Twitter's made it almost instantaneous now.
Absolutely. And just to give a bit of a sense of what you see as your big scoops, your really impactful stories that you published over the years, what are a handful that stick out?
I guess the most famous one that really was a breakthrough moment was in 2009 when we got hold of Dame McBride's emails to a guy called Derek Draper. Dame McBride was Gordon Brown's much feared and legendary spin doctor. He was, official title, I think, was head of press and communications. And Derek Draper was setting up a rival website to Guido because they felt it was hurting. You know, we'd done quite a lot of stories that painted them as sleazy. And also we exacerbated the conflict between the Blairites and the Brownites quite successfully. So they decided they wanted their own gossip thing that would, expose their enemies. Unfortunately, when you were paid by the taxpayer, you worked for Gordon Brown and look after his moral compass, suggesting a load of smears about genital warts on the opposition leader and opposition figures, it looks bad. And it did have an impact. And the fact that it was a sort of email story and we had the evidence and it was all kind of new, that made the press even more excited. So it was front page news for 2 weeks. And after the first weekend when it came out, it knocked Labour down by 5 points in the polls. It was kind of the Tories' breakthrough. It also had, because of the way the story was done, it was an email story and we'd released it, and we'd gone to two papers. I learned when you want to get follow-up, if you go to one, they can do it the way they like. If you go to two, they kind of have to give you the credit. And the fact that it was broken by a blog was part of the story. So that was when I guess you could put a zero on our readership.
And you've talked a little bit about how the sort of blogging landscape has changed, but how do you feel the landscape for just press freedom in general has shifted? I know you gave evidence yourself at the Leveson inquiry when that whole crusade was taking off. And there has been a general sense that the kinds of stories that Guido would publish, things that were more about scandal, that were more about gossip, have become more difficult to publish.
I think we don't officially have a privacy law in this country, but the judges have made privacy law from the bench. And I'll give you a recent story we did, which no newspaper followed up. And you might say for good reason, for taste or in their judgment. But we did Angela Rayner's son's porn career with some tastefully, artfully obscured pictures. And it's definitely something people talk about. It speaks to, it was in the context of her renting out or not renting out, as she claimed, her council flat, the house that she'd bought. So there was kind of interest in the geography and the topology of where does the family live? Because she claimed she didn't live with her husband and kids, that she lived with her brother who didn't pay her rent. It was all very complicated. But in the course of that, we found out about his OnlyFans account. It's a cracking story. The soon-to-be deputy leader of the Labour Party, deputy leader of the Labour Party and soon-to-be deputy prime minister, has a son with an interesting career choice. Not one single paper followed that up. And that's not because their readers wouldn't be interested. It's because there was no excuse they could give to a judge for running it, because the public being interested is not the same as the public interest. I don't think that's a good development. I don't want us to be like France, where politicians can run, you know, multiple mistresses and act as, you know, conservative, Christian, church-going family men.
Yeah, I've heard from a few people over the last couple of years that, you know, the press is sitting on a whole load of stories of back in the day, the News of the World, they would have just put straight out there because they're the concern that, you know, supposedly they're not going to be seen as being in the public interest and therefore illegal. Are you sat on a whole load of stories, Paul?
Well, we're sat on stories that we can't stand up, that I believe to be true, and that we shouldn't, we shouldn't run if we can't stand it up, right? But there's also, for instance, if an unmarried MP is sexually promiscuous, that is not reportable in the press anymore. You know, there's, and maybe it shouldn't be, but it's a fact that it's not reportable. And I think in times gone by, if someone was a bit of a playboy MP, it would have been reported. It might have been reported in a tasteful way in a diary column with pictures of him with different women every night, but it's just not reported now. And that's because there's no public interest reason for running a story about someone's character as opposed to, you know, something related to their job. Or you have to have a security angle generally on these things. So when they do actually do someone over, it's for the most tenuous security reason, or it's for expense related. You know, he bought his girlfriend a ticket on the taxpayer, or it's staff. Now, the odd thing about the staff one is I seem to recall knowing lots of MPs who married their secretaries and had happy relationships. At some point, I assume they put their hand on her knee. You know, and now that is a sackable offence and you'll be exposed in newspapers for it. So mores have changed in both directions.
And am I right in thinking that, say, something like the Matt Hancock, Gina Colodangelo clinches during lockdown, if it wasn't for the fact that he was breaking his own lockdown rules, do you think that story would have seen the light of day?
Well, you would be able to do that one because, assuming you had the evidence, because he's a married minister, she was married and she worked for him. So shagging in the office is still reportable, I think, on the taxpayer's dime. I mean,
that's the crucial thing. You know, Guido have been really at the forefront of pushing some really big stories. You know, what are your worst kind of brushes with lawyers' letters?
Well, only very rich people can afford to go after you in defamation. Currently, and for the first time ever, I am in court after 20 years with Dale Vince, the green oligarch. And he is very litigious. And he said something, he said a complete howler about, he equated Hamas, I'll be careful what he said. He said one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter when he was asked about Hamas on Times Radio. And we we put the headlines in saying, you know, it's a disgrace, in our opinion, that he's equated them and they're not freedom fighters. And he's taken great offence to it and says that we've accused him of supporting terrorism. And if I wanted to accuse him of supporting terrorism, we'd have written that. But we didn't. We just said it was a terrible thing that he's equated them with freedom fighters. And this is immediately after the October 7th atrocities. So I think a few MPs, Tory MPs, retweeted the story or commented on it. Sean Bailey, Lord Bailey, said something about it on GB News. Richard Tice retweeted it and added his own comment. And he's threatened to sue us all. And I just thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is our opinion about a matter of public policy. If you start trying to commit lawfare when you're having a debate about matters, that's not good. So I said, well, I'm not backing down. Sean Bailey took the same view. Actually, it's complicated. GB News, their insurers, their libel insurers, insisted that they apologise. The Daily Mail actually cocked it up and said something completely different and probably did libel him. And they decided that, you know, apology and quick 10 grand was cheaper. And so it just leaves me, Tice, and Sean Bailey, who are just not backing down, not apologising, not bending the knee. So that could be a very expensive decision. But that's where we are. I don't think... I kind of believe that even though on common sense it sounds like we should win, I know that common sense isn't necessarily how the law works. I just think the judge will see what's really happened here, and I don't think he'd want to decide against us. I think it's going to go our way. But Dale's got unlimited funds, effectively, and he'll carry on. I mean, he's got a very thin skin.
Chris, you got any questions for Paul here before we move on to the nanny state section?
Well, I'm not going to say anything about Dale Vince, that's for sure. I don't know. I mean, it's just I'm just pleased that the Guido blog has been going so long and has kept ticking over, much as it always did, you know, because there was a golden age of blogging in the noughties, and it all came to an end, really, when everyone went on Twitter. There's hardly any people really blogging. Tim Warstall's one who's still doing it just like he used to, which is great. But, you know, pre-Twitter, there was a lovely kind of community of bloggers who would all link to each other, and you'd sit down on a Sunday night and catch up with what everyone's been saying. And I still do it a bit. I suppose the Substack has taken over a bit as well, hasn't it? You know, but it's yeah, great for those who are still doing it. And I mean, I know Guido's not really a blog like Tim or
the difference between opinion and news, isn't it? Opinion's quite cheap to do, isn't it, Chris? Because you just opinionate. News takes a bit of effort.
Oh, it does, exactly, yeah. That's why I draw the distinction. But it's still, you know, it physically still looks quite similar to it was originally.
I'm approached by, you know, social media gurus, and they always say, oh, it looks a bit out of date. I'm like, well, you know, the top thing is the latest story, and you just scroll down and you get through it, and if you come late in the day, you press the next page, and you'll see the earlier day story. It's a simple system, and I noticed that, you know, we make money, and all the people who make money on the internet and have been around a while, Drudge, Hot Bitch, myself, we haven't changed our format that much. Now, the underlying architecture might have changed a bit, and we might do some cleverer things, but the format hasn't changed that much.
Which I like.
And so, Paul, you're handing over to Ross, or now Lord Kempsel, I should say. What's next for you? Are you still going to be bumping around SW1, or have you got other things on the pipeline?
Sort of, you know, Ross has hinted that, could I stay away from Twitter? And to be honest, it's good for him that he runs his show the way he wants to, and he will. And I'm sure he'll do a good job, and I'm sure there'll be changes. And that's the way it should be. And I shouldn't try and backseat drive, and I won't. Well, I hope I won't. And I am still quite busy. I still have some interests in Westminster politics, given I own an advertising agency, or I'm a shareholder in an advertising agency that specialises in kind of SW1 things. I've started another advertising agency in Mumbai, where I've been spending quite a lot of my time in the last year, which is fascinating. I mean, India is just the biggest booming opportunity on the planet. And I think sometimes people don't realise how, you know, the centre of power has moved eastwards. China, India, all the Middle Eastern countries, you know, the GDP over there is booming, and it's pretty static in Europe.
Fascinating. And we shall look ahead to all of that with interest. Chris, should we move on to the nanny state section of the podcast? Not that we limit it to that, but there's a couple of stories that you wanted to pick out in particular. Should we start with the second reading vote for our old friend, the Tobacco and Vapes Bill? Do you want to remind us what's happened there?
Yeah, it was just a landslide victory for the government. I mean, nobody doubted it was going to go through. All you can say is, you know, credit to the 47 MPs who, knowing they were going to be on the losing side, nevertheless went out and voted against his stupid piece of prohibition. And I think history would judge him kindly. Particular shout out to the 7 or 8 Lib Dems. I know it's only 10% of the parliamentary party these days, but still, you're so used to Lib Dems being the least liberal party in parliament. It's nice to see a few of them had the backbone to vote against this particular policy. I mean, we've talked about the details of this bill again and again and again, and we'll get more detail of what it actually contains after it's been through committee, I suppose. But yeah, look, it's pretty depressing that it was sort of 9-1 in favour of this, albeit with the Labour Party being whipped and a lot of Tories staying away. So look, you know, the 47 MPs, their hands are clean. They can sleep soundly at night.
And Paul, to bring you in here, on a scale of 1 to 10, how depressed have you been by the fact that we are now ushering in the prohibition of smoking, originally under the Tory party, now under the Labour party?
Well, I think we've always been not only libertarian, but libertine at Guido. And we lived the message, you know. So I stopped smoking a few years ago, but all the people who seem to work for me do vape. It seems healthier than smoking, right? And certainly smells better. So on practical grounds, I'm against it. And I'm just always against prohibition of any kind for all the reasons I'm sure you guys and your listeners know. And, you know, I'd go further. I want to liberalize recreational drugs in all directions. So it's depressing. I noticed, though, that going back to India, vaping is banned in India because the national champion doesn't have a vape product. Yet all the kids still vape. So there's quite a big contraband market in vaping over there. The rich kids vape, sorry, all the masses still smoke.
Which is the way the Indian government likes it, given that it's the major shareholder of the Indian Tobacco Company. Vietnam's just banned vaping for a similar reason. The government is the major shareholder of the Vietnamese main tobacco company. Follow the money with some of this. And in both cases, the WHO was straight out of the blocks applauding and congratulating the health minister for banning vaping.
Which is tough because the local cigarettes are quite rough, you know. Combined with, you know, the Delhi smog, I'm not sure that vaping is the biggest problem they face.
Yes. Well, they had the big World Health Organization anti-smoking conference in Delhi a few years ago, and the smog was particularly bad. It was like the worst smog they'd had all year. And so Deborah Arnott from ASH came back coughing, literally coughing for a couple of weeks. Not because of the tobacco smoke, but because of the smog. So yes, I think they do have bigger concerns, even when it comes to air pollution.
And isn't that picture, Chris, of you mentioned this in your blog about how even now, and we've talked about it a few times on the show, even now the kind of black market for both tobacco and vape products is huge. And you kind of, it's not just, you know, you're buying it in a car park, you're buying it in corner shops. Is there still just a complete willful blindness to that from government as they go about banning these things more formally?
Yeah, completely willful, because they've completely given up any reasonable attempt to estimate, even loosely estimate, how much of the black market, how much of the tobacco market is illicit. Their most recent claim from HMRC, and this is now based on basically nothing but just a guess, is that 6% of cigarettes sold in this country are illicit. Well, that's just so obviously untrue. All you have to do, as I've said before, go to if you're standing outside the pub with some smokers, see what bags they've got in their hands. Do they have plain packs? Probably not. Have they got English warnings on them? Probably not. I mentioned on the blog, you know, I don't smoke anymore, so I don't see it quite as firsthand as I might do. But I was in, I won't name it, but I was in a city in the Northwest a couple of weeks ago on a night out, and my trusty vape, which I'd had for a good 2 years, suddenly malfunctioned. So I went off looking for a disposable, and I thought I'd buy a pack of cigarettes as well, because I might not like the disposable. And so I went into this shop, and it was kind of advertising halal meat, and I thought this would be a good place to get a disposable vape. Went in, saw the guy, said, right, I'll have that disposable vape up there, and a lighter, and do you sell cigarettes? And this fella, who'd obviously never seen me in his life, just whipped out a massive plastic bag from under the counter and starts slapping them down. Yeah, we got this, all in different packaging, all with different languages and health warnings. And I said, okay, I'll have that one, Marlboro Touch, I think it's called. And he goes, that'd be £15. Now, a pack of the cigarettes alone would be at least £15. You know, I actually misheard him. I thought he said £50. He was trying to rip me off. I said, £50? He goes, okay, here, £14. So we got £14, pack of premium cigarettes, a lighter and disposable vape. Very, very obviously not legal. Probably the disposable vape wasn't legal either. And that was in the middle of a city centre to somebody he's never seen before. This is happening up and down the country. And, you know, to answer your question, no, the government just doesn't want to know. It's losing tobacco duty at quite a hefty rate. We're down £1.5 billion in 2 years in terms of annual tobacco duty revenue. There's a black hole that, you know, you could easily be dealt with just by cutting tobacco duty. But of course, they're not going to do that. So they just don't care anymore.
It certainly seems like it. And Paul, do you think we're going to have our kind of most nanny state government ever?
Well, I think Rishi was quite nanny, wasn't he? He basically didn't like smoking, you know, and took a sort of moral position on it. So I think it would be as nanny. Whether it could be even more money, how can it be? It was all going in one direction pretty quickly with that under Rishi. So it's pretty depressing. And there's another cultural thing that I find depressing is the kids aren't so rebellious now. I am a father of two daughters, so perhaps I should take some comfort from this. But teenage pregnancy falling off a cliff, they're not having sex.
It's a real sign of decline that no one wants to admit.
They microdose. God, what happened to overdosing? What's going wrong? It's just like despair at the sensibilities of it.
It's a real sign of decline. Lack of teen pregnancies and overdoses.
Pronouns instead of going out and having a good time. What is wrong with these kids?
You know? Some of them are still all right, in my experience, going around universities and that. Some of them are still pretty good. Yeah. Should we move on to the other Sunak policy that's been brought over? Yet another one, along with the football regulator and everything else. You know? So the so-called junk food advertising ban has yet again been announced, this time with some actual legislation. And finally, I've been shouting into a void about this for over 5 years, trying to say this is not junk food ads that are being banned. This is just food ads. And no one's paid any attention. The media constantly refer to this advertising ban as related to junk food and nearly always show a big, fat, greasy burger. And now people realize actually it applies to things like croissants and porridge. Porridge got the most of the headlines when this was announced. And the story here is, you know, Boris Johnson, post-COVID, he's a bit dazed and confused. He's looking for some distraction. And he's also under a lot of pressure from the Department of Health, who's surrounding him during this whole COVID period. And bloody Chris Whitty, who, as always, is the root of the evil. And he comes out July 2020, says we're going to ban junk food advertising, but there's no definition of junk food. So they use the definition they've been using for the advertising ban during children's programs, which everyone's forgotten about, which is actually high in fat, sugar, and salt. But when Sadiq Khan introduced a ban on that basis on the underground, it led to lots of absurdities and him being laughed at because they were having to pull down posters for cheese and jam and butter and stuff. So the government's trying to use a different definition and said, well, we'll just include things that are in Public Health England's reformulation program. But then Public Health England got closed down, the reformulation program wasn't working too well. And also it still left loads of absurdities because, you know, you get rid of things like raisins and olives if you exclude things that are not in the reformulation program. Yeah, olives are too fatty, as is olive oil, as is butter.
I thought olive oil was good for you. I'm so out of touch.
Well, yeah, not according to this particular definition. It's just based on, you know, the amount of fat and sugar and salt in each of the products, and indeed the amount of calories. And so in the end, 2021, I think it was Javid was health minister by then. It's hard to keep up. But he basically just said, I'm just going to make up a list of things that I think are bad. So there's no science behind it at all. And they started calling it less healthy food rather than HFSS or junk food or anything. And that kind of, well, that's led to where we are now, because the list that was published this week by Streeting, effectively, was just exactly the same as the Tory list, except that Labour have added in sandwiches.
I saw Wes last night at 2:30 in the morning. He was absolutely smashed. I think he might have been over his guidance on the alcohol units count by a long way at 2:30 a.m. this morning.
Well, not a case of do as I say, not as I do from a senior politician. So, yeah, if you look at the list, it is kind of absurd because it does include mostly things actually that people don't consider to be junk food, but it could never, you know, there was never a legal way of only picking on KFC and Pizza Hut, right? Because there would be judicial reviews going like, well, how come you're not going for the sourdough pizza guy down the road or what have you? So they just picked this fairly arbitrary list. So it doesn't include things like pork pies or sausage rolls, but it does include things like potato croquettes and various pastries and so on. So it's daft. But the Tories who have been complaining about it, there's one called Andrew Griffiths, tweeted this week. UK government now officially lost the plot. 5,700 word regulations to prohibit TV adverts for muesli and yogurt. Anyone wonder why UK economic growth is anemic? This is their policy. Right? And it's their list of products. You know, Labour have just cut and pasted it. So a lot of this terrible stuff that we've been putting up with for 5 months, it's just Labour finishing off Rishi Sunak's agenda, because you can't put a cigarette paper between Labour and the Tories on this stuff. And incidentally, cigarette papers are also in the Tobacco and Vapes Bill or something that you won't be able to buy if you're born after 2008.
I'm really surprised that the advertising industry didn't push back harder on this than they did, because...
And the food industry.
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, well, the food industry can just do more expensive products that meet the guidelines, I suppose, but...
No, they can't. Not with loads of stuff. Most of this stuff can't be reformulated, and people won't eat it. It's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, in America, they do fight hard to protect advertising freedom. They've got commercial advertising. I think it's protected under the Constitution. They didn't have an argument that commercial advertising is free speech as well.
Yeah, they can't ban tobacco advertising completely in America for that reason.
Oh well. I enjoy living on whatever you're not. Oh, I was going to say porridge, but you're not even going to be allowed porridge, are you? To be honest, I've never been that keen on that Calvinist porridge, the water and salt that the Scottish like. You know, so I wouldn't miss that, but I would miss the creamy.
Oh yeah, that would be too salty, wouldn't it? Yeah, that might get bad.
That's hilarious. Yeah, even the most.
So any flavour?
Yeah, well, that's essentially what it is. I mean, how else do you get flavour in food than using fat, sugar and salt, really?
My wife's been nagging me to use olive oil. Is olive oil on the list?
No, spreads have been taken off. But it's on the original list. It's on the original HFSS list.
The fact that they're going through it in this kind of quite sort of style of this fashion.
Oh, yeah. You can just imagine the civil service, you know, how many years this has taken, and them arguing about whether we should put potato waffles on. And if we've got potato waffles, shouldn't we have potato croquettes?
Do smiley faces qualify, obviously? Do potato waffles, maybe not?
You know, there's some angry vegan who's behind this, isn't there? You know, just making our lives miserable.
Maybe Dale Vince soon enough.
The vegans are in trouble because most of their stuff is ultra-processed, you see. So they're coming for them next. Which, and to be fair, I wouldn't mind that. You know, first they came for the vegans, but that was all right with me.
Oh, before we get out of here, Chris, you wanted to talk briefly about the Brighton i360 and the fact that it's gone bust.
Yeah, it's a bit off topic, but it's been...
There's part of this podcast which just has whatever has ground your gears this week, I suppose. So we can put it into that, you know.
Yeah, we'll put it in the sort of, if you were a dictator for a day, what would you ban? The Brighton i360 is this ridiculous folly that was built in 2016 in Brighton. I used to live in Brighton. I don't now, and I don't often go there. And it is a nice place, Brighton, you know. The trouble is, it's always, as long as I've lived down south, been run by imbeciles. For a very long time, they had a completely green council. Now it's kind of, I think it's now Labour, but it was Green and Labour in between. Anyway, when it was Green, they commissioned this ludicrous structure, which is kind of like a polo going up and down a pencil, if you can imagine that, which sounds slightly sexual, isn't it? Not to get too Greg Wallace about it, like, but I think Freud would have something to say about this particular structure. And so you get in this polo / donut thing, and you go up this pole, and you just get a slightly better view of the sea, really. I mean, you just see the English Channel from a higher vantage point, which is mostly now in Brighton just a view of wind turbines anyway. And then you come down again, and it costs £15 for this. And unsurprisingly, there's not enough people want to do it. They needed more than 1,000 people per day all year round to cover their costs. And they've unsurprisingly not been able to achieve this. So now it's gone into administration, leaving the taxpayer £51 million in the hole. It's just another classic example of stupid government waste, really. My wife went up it, actually, on some works do shortly after it opened. And it's got a bar in it, but the bar's just on one side of the polo mint. So they went up, and then immediately everybody went to the bar, and the thing kind of twisted and like bent downwards because all the weight was on one side of it. And it got stuck. And it was stuck for about 90 minutes or so, maybe 2 hours. And although it's got a bar, it doesn't have a toilet because it's only supposed to be up there for about 10 or 15 minutes. So they thought, well, we don't need a toilet. So as you can imagine, it seems as all these people drinking pints realized they weren't going to be coming out for quite a long time and there was no toilet. So that was an early sign to me that this was not maybe going to work. So, yeah, I mean, the conclusion is I hate Brighton and Hove City Council and any politician who wastes our money on ridiculous follies like HS2.
Paul, unless you've got any comments you want to make on the pencil and the polo mint, we should go to our final question, which we'd like to ask guests on this show, because we are very libertarian and anti-ban. If you were dictator for the day, as Chris suggested there, and you had to have one ban, what would it be? The only rules are that it can't be worthy, or it can't be, you can't ban a liberalism or whatever. But if just something that really irks you.
I can't think of anything I want to ban. I was going to say knives, but that sounded a bit worthy. You know, teenagers with knives. Actually, I don't believe in children having freedom. Having now just gone through the parental line, I don't believe that under 16-year-olds should have any freedom, and we can ban them from social media and for own good, and they can do their bloody homework and take your feet off the chair as well while you're at it.
So banning social media for kids. That's another Sunak policy.
I think the Aussies have just done it. And I just think, well, my brain was warped by Twitter for years. And if you've got basically psychological warfare techniques being used on children to get them to keep on the app, that's not good. And it just sucks up all their time, makes them unhappy. I mean, one thing that...
Stops them getting pregnant.
Does stop them getting pregnant, I suppose. No, I don't believe children should have that much freedom. And I think their parents should control them. You don't need all these advertising bans. Your parents should make you eat the right things. Eat your greens.
It's a very wholesome point to end on. Paul, Chris, thank you both very much.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.